Sweet Mercy.
Wow.
100,000 people with nothing better to do on a Sunday afternoon. Okay, how many of you here have a television? Stick your hands up. How many of you here have seen this man walking the Nile on your telly? Good. We're all in the right place. For those of you watching in black and white, I'm Paul Blezard. This is the very colourful Leveson Wood, who's got a new book out called Walking the Himalayas. Has the show gone out yet or not?
It's already been out.
Yeah. How many of you have seen him walking the Himalayas? Right, so we're not going to cover. We're going to cover some of the ground of what he did, but I thought we'd spend this next half an hour of him and I chatting, trying to find out sort of what goes on behind the scenes when we're sitting in our comfortable sofas and armchairs watching Leveson put himself his feet through torture. What really goes on? But let's start with a slightly obvious question. Actually, forgive me for it. What was the idea? The philosophy of the documentary that you were going to make, of the journey that you were going to take?
Okay, well, first of all, thank you everyone for coming. This is a great crowd. In terms of what the philosophy was, apart from the fact that I clearly really like walking, so last year I did another expedition walking the Nile, and after that, I said I'd never walk anywhere ever again.
Really? Did you mean it? Was it that?
Well,
it
I
was
did
that,
mean it. Actually,
that enduring, it that
was,
onerous.
It was hard work, and I thought I'd had my fill.
Right.
But then, after about 3 months, you know, you kind of forget the bad bits.
Yeah, quite.
And then people start asking you what's next, and so on. And so I wanted to come up with an idea that was, you know, on the same level in terms of both the endurance, the scale of the challenge. But more importantly, somewhere that was just really interesting to me personally. And I'd travelled quite extensively in the Himalayas before, both as, you know, just backpacking as a solo traveller. I'd been to various parts with the army.
Yeah.
And doing a bit of mountaineering. So I thought, why not go to a place that I know quite well and write a book about it and show the side of things that people don't necessarily automatically assume, you know, would be associated with the Himalayas.
So what do you think our preconceptions of the Himalayas are? For those of us who are armchair travellers that haven't been, what do you think we think the Himalayas are that actually they're not when you get there?
I think people generally, you know, if you say the word Himalayas, people will think automatically, you know, Mount Everest.
Everest!
Snowy peaks. But actually, the reality is that... Sorry, is this not working properly? People are pointing at me.
Can you hear us at the back? Can you hear me? Thumbs up.
No,
can you hear Leveson?
I need to speak up, do I? Is that better?
Look at me.
Sorry.
There we go.
Better?
Oh, Jesus.
Okay. We'll start again.
Forgive me for fiddling with you.
So, people generally say, you know, you say the word Himalayas, you think Everest. The reality is, I started in Afghanistan, a place that's got connotations.
Yep.
Walked through Pakistan, India, Nepal, and finished in Bhutan. All very, very different countries. And what struck me most was the diversity. And that's what I wanted to show people, was the diversity in culture, in language, in religion. And ultimately, you know, all these very different communities of people that don't really have anything in common apart from this great mountain range that they live on and the daily challenges and struggles that they come up against, you know, every day.
I know only too well, to my own cost, that sometimes you set out on a great adventure, the great army phrase being time spent on reconnaissance is never time wasted. You plan what you're going to do for the month, for the 2 months, for the 3 months. Mm-hmm. But then the moment you set off, reality kicks in.
It all goes to pot.
The plan goes out the window. What was the first big diversion? Well, let's start with your setting off point. What had you planned for the first couple of weeks? What was the reality versus the dream?
Well, I wanted to start, you know, in the farthest western reaches of the Greater Himalayan Range, which ultimately meant the convergence of the Karakoram Mountains, the Hindu Kush, which is really on the border with China, Afghanistan, and Tajikistan. And it's this really remote part of Afghanistan that, you know, very few people have heard about, let alone visited. But it's one of the most spectacular places in the world, the Wakhan Corridor, that really, you know, is completely safe. First off, there's no Taliban, there's no violence. It's just inhabited by nomads, by yeah. Kyrgyz and wacky nomads that live a very basic existence. And I really wanted to show that part of the world, you know, in its real gritty rawness. And this is a place where, you know, life expectancy is 35.
Quite.
It's got the highest infant mortality rates in the world. It's a brutal existence. And you know, that was one of the biggest challenges. You know, just to get there involves either a week-long drive from Tajikistan. I was lucky enough to manage to bag a lift on a helicopter from Kabul and get dropped off in the middle of nowhere. But it was literally, you know, out you get and off you go. So we had, the first challenge was just try to find some pack animals to carry the gear.
Right.
Which involved having to go and convince this nomadic tribesman of my good intentions. And one of the first tests that I was up against was having to eat the delicacies of a goat, which involved the brains and the eyeballs. Funnily enough, he wasn't eating any of the brains and the eyeballs.
How does it taste?
Well, the eyeball was all right, actually. The brains was a bit like foie gras, quite creamy. Yeah.
Cool. How much kit do you take? Just lift the veil a bit on what goes on behind the scenes in producing a show such as the show that you've made.
Yep.
I was talking to Mick Confrey here a couple of days ago. For any of his interest in the Karakoram Mountains, not least K2, the second most highest mountain in the world, the world's most savage mountain, he was saying some of the early expeditions, including by Aleister Crowley, you know, would take 150 tons of kit. They'd have to hire a village full of mule herders and mules and sheep and so on just to keep the thing moving, to keep it fed. These days you travel lighter, but for a BBC documentary, what do you need?
Channel 4,
forgive me. I do apologise. I will shoot myself in the foot afterwards.
Well, I didn't carry 150 tonnes of kit, luckily. There was, you know, so on this journey, the film crew came out for portions, right, similarly to my Nile expedition. So they would come out for a week or a couple of weeks, disappear off for a month, and then come back later. And it was quite nice to have the variety, you know, of to have the companionship of the crew. And I say the crew, it wasn't a big team. It was, you know, the cameraman, the director, and the guy that looked after the security, effectively. So pretty small teams, you know, with a couple of local translators. You know, they would come in. And so, you know, to carry the camera equipment, which wasn't a great deal, but you still need a few pack animals. You know, sure, we had maybe three or four yaks or four or five donkeys at any one stage in the more remote regions. When you get to places like India, of course, it's a lot easier. You know, there are roads.
Quite.
But in parts of northern Pakistan, certainly in Bhutan, you know, there's just nothing.
Yeah. Okay, bring us into the northern part of India, to sort of always Kashmir and so on. I mean, we know of it, so much of it, from the sort of hippie trail of the 1960s, 1970s. The Beatles went there, as you say, in the book. You know, there's a sense of you're entering Shangri-La, the Dope Trail, all that sort of stuff. Does that still exist in the 21st century? Are there echoes of that?
I think it exists in people's imaginations and in people's living memories. Unfortunately, not as many people visit there. So, parts of India, yes, Dharamsala, Rishikesh, you know, the Ganges. People still do visit there. There's lots of people doing yoga on the banks of the Ganges, and I think there is that mindset. People, some of the older generation of Indians, do sort of hark back to those days. And as a traveller there, you're constantly asked, you know, questions about when the next batch of hippies are going to turn up and keep them in business. But unfortunately, not. You know, certainly parts of Pakistan have pretty much disappeared off the tourist trail altogether, and it's a shame because it's an incredible part of the world. It's really beautiful and very, very hospitable people, in fact.
Well, talk us through some of the people that you met, because one of the things this book is really good at is you talking about some of the characters that you met, which of course makes any destination, whether you're traveling to Greece for a summer holiday or whether you're doing something a little more adventurous. It's about the people that we meet that let us into their lives, give us an illustration of how they live. Talk us through some of your great characters.
Well, for me, that's what this journey was about. It was about those encounters. And I think there's something about walking in particular that I found means that you tend to meet a lot of interesting people, and you meet it on a level playing field. I think by the very fact that you're putting yourself, you know, at the same sort of vulnerabilities and the same risks, and ultimately, but on foot, you can visit places that you simply can't get to by vehicle or any other way. And also people tend to view you less as a tourist or a foreigner and more as a fellow human being.
Yes, quite.
And so what that means is that you tend to get invited to people's homes, you can relate to people on that basis. And so you meet more people. And I was very fortunate to meet everyone, you know, from your sort of your man in the field who would invite you in for a cup of tea, all the way up to the Dalai Lama. And that was, you know, down to the fact that I was in Dharamsala, knocked on his door, and got invited by the private secretary to come and meet the most famous man of the Himalayas himself.
This was not pre-planned at all. You literally turned up and knocked on the door.
Well, the production team had been trying to get hold of him for months, right. And they were saying, look, he's a busy man, can't guarantee if he's going to be in residence at the time. In fact, I was told he was at Glastonbury when I was going to be there.
was he headlining on the private stage?
Him and Kanye West. So it just turned out that the day that I did arrive, he was in town. And he said, come tomorrow. And I thought it was just going to be a 10-second meet and greet. Thank you very much, and off you go. But actually, I found myself in a queue of about 200 people. Most of these guys were either monks or pilgrims from Tibet, right, who'd actually taken the real risk of smuggling themselves over the mountains just to meet their spiritual leader, and then to go back again. But the Dalai Lama, and I think that the Tibetans are they're acutely aware of the power of PR.
Yes.
And so I was sort of snatched out of the queue and taken into the Dalai Lama's living room and told to sit down and wait. And there was myself and Ash, the cameraman, and we were sort of, what's the one question you would ask the man who's supposed to be the living incarnation of God, given the chance? And you kind of have a bit of a mind blank, actually. And the best that we can come up with was, have you ever worn trousers?
You get 5 minutes of the Dalai Lama, and that's what you ask.
I didn't ask him that, no.
What did you ask?
Well, I was kind of hoping that I'd come away with the meaning of life. But what I actually got was lots of very practical visa advice on how to get into China. So, a bit disappointing, really.
Yeah, very practical, though, as you say. Did you get your white silk scarf right?
Got the white silk scarf, yeah.
Pride of place in your house?
Very much so.
Yeah, exactly. You're army trained, so you're used to hardship. But when you're doing a long walk like this, it is tough. It's tough on the feet, tough on the knees, tough on the hips as you get older like me. How do you deal with that? Because, it is a physical challenge you're undertaking. We get to see it from comfort, but you're going through it. Do you get days of boredom where you think, what the hell am I doing? Why did I not train to be an accountant rather than finding myself here?
Physically, yes, it's a challenge. And I think, the army training and any training really prepares you for that.
Yeah.
But I think the real challenge is mentally, actually, putting your life in a box for however long, 6 months, 9 months, with an indeterminate end date, and you, off you go. And, you sort of have to say goodbye to everyone. And the mental, I guess, the monotony at times, you see on TV is 5 hours of the best bits or the exciting bits or the dangerous bits. What you don't see is, the 90% of the time where you're just walking along a pretty boring road. And that can sometimes be the biggest challenge. Probably less so in the Himalayas because it is so varied and so diverse and you've got quite nice views. More so on the last expedition on the Nile when you're walking across flat deserts, then it can be a bit more of a mental challenge to deal with. But because I had done a big expedition before, I'd done several expeditions before, but being away previously on the Nile, I kind of knew what to expect this time around. So right. it was less of a surprise as to how bored I was going to be.
You mentioned the E word at the top of this conversation. How close to Everest did you get?
Well, the route that I was taking, I wasn't there to bag peaks. I wasn't there as a mountaineer. I've done a bit of climbing in the past, but ultimately this was a journey to meet the cultures and the people. So really, I was kind of following a trail that wound through the mountains, through the valleys, through the inhabited parts. But I couldn't really resist the temptation to go and see Everest. So when I got to a place called Charakot, which is sort of parallel with the mountain, and I confess, I managed to get Channel 4 to pay for a helicopter to go and fly over it, land at Kalapatar, get some nice photos, and then come back down.
So very different from BBC budgets. For those of you that were hearing Simon Reeve earlier on, how many of you saw that when he was allowed to budget to buy a pair of socks to walk around Central Asia, but then had to give them back at the end of 3 months of trudging around laundered happily. There's a nice little passage about this, about the Ganges, that you're on the shores of the Ganges and you look at the cremations that go on. Mm. Talk us through how that felt when you're seeing one of the sort of iconic rivers of the world being used properly, but by the people that live there, both for their spiritual needs and also for their sort of cleanliness and water needs.
Yeah, there's something quite humbling about how people treat nature.
Yeah.
Particularly in the Himalayas, in India and Nepal. I think there's something about that Hindu spirituality that it's quite appealing. It's quite, it's very endearing to see people, you know, I guess, utilizing something like the mountains or the rivers for a very spiritual purpose. And what's not so endearing is seeing somebody, you know, answering the call of nature there and somebody having a wash just there. So you kind of get used to that, though, and you see it. And but it's very practical. It's very matter of fact. And to see the way that cremations are carried out, you know, literally a corpse will be on the top of a minibus. It will sort of be brought down, burnt, and the pundit, the guy who's conducting the ceremony, will be sort of half on his mobile phone and half, you know, doing his thing and just getting on with it. And I think death is very much seen as a part of life in that respect. It didn't come across as being too emotional almost. And
it's part of the natural continuum.
Yeah, and I guess when you know you believe in reincarnation, it becomes less of an issue, I suppose, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. What moved you most on this journey?
What moved me most? Probably when I went flying off a cliff and broke my arm. And
you had a very lucky escape.
Very lucky escape, indeed.
Tell us what happened.
Well, basically, I got to a small village. There was lots of problems in Nepal when I was there. Well, they've been ongoing for the best part of 15 years, actually. There's been a Maoist insurgency. There's been some political issues, which, when I was there, meant that the borders with India were closed to fuel. There were strikes, there were riots, protests. It's because, long story short, I got to a town. They said that, you know, you're not allowed to stay here. The Maoists have taken over the village, and they didn't want foreigners there, which is very unlike Nepal, because they are very, very friendly people. But they said, look, for your own safety, you need to, you know, push on out of here. There's no, you know, we're closing all of the hotels and guest houses, and, you know, you need to go to the next place. So I took their advice, got in a local taxi, and just as I was going over a mountain pass, the brakes failed and basically went flying off the edge of a 150-meter cliff and somehow survived.
It must have been terrifying.
No, it
was. Just gonna try, is there anybody on that camera at the back? Is there anybody running the camera? Can you zoom in on that at all? This picture here. Is that possible? If I can keep it really, really, really still. That was the result of the crash. I mean, you could have died.
Yeah, no, I was lucky not to.
Let's not beat around her.
Yeah.
You broke your arm?
I broke my arm and my shoulder. But what moved me the most was actually
thank you.
The fact that within half an hour or so, the entire, and this was at night as well, the entire village nearby had somehow heard this, and they came out and you know, carried me out of this to the nearest sort of clinic.
It gives you a sort of different insight about travelling, which is how the national healthcare system works where you are travelling through.
Yeah.
What do you have to report? Given you may want to go back there.
It was fairly rudimentary, I would say. I mean, there was a few chickens running around the ward. But apart from that, you know, I was well looked after. They had morphine, which was the main thing. They didn't have any facilities to actually do anything about my broken arm.
No,
so it took a week before I actually got any, you know, anything done to it. But still, you know, it worked. It took a bit of time, but eventually, after a few days, I managed to get a helicopter and get CASEVAC'd and looked at. But it could have been a lot worse.
Could have been a lot worse.
Yeah.
Bring us to Bhutan, then. There is a stand here. I don't know if anybody's seen yet. I think it's the first time they've been here. The sort of Bhutan Tourist Board are promoting people to go to Bhutan. Of course, it's sort of been the hidden land for so long. I think the limit is 100,000 people a year are allowed to go. Is it still 100,000?
I don't know. Yeah, I think there's basically a daily fee. So you pay a set fee, and that gives you, you know, your guide, your vehicle, your accommodation. I think it's about $250, so 150 quid, which actually, when you think about it, sounds expensive, but you know, that does include everything.
Great.
So if you can make it, you can go for, say, 5 days from India. And go and see one of the most spectacular and untouched countries in the world.
How many people here have been to Bhutan? Stick your hand up if you've been to Bhutan. My goodness, you see, we're at a proper travel show. For those that haven't, tell us what it's like, because it is one of the most unique and special destinations in the world, I think.
It is. It was a real privilege to go to Bhutan. It's a place that, it's quite mysterious, you know, people's imaginations. It's a country of only about 800,000 people.
Yep.
Only 70,000 people live in Thimphu, the capital. That's sort of less than Wembley Stadium. So it's a tiny population in an otherwise pristine natural environment. You know, I think Steve Batchel was there looking for tigers recently.
Yes.
And they found, you know, unheard of populations of tigers. It's an incredible place naturally, and also culturally it's very unique. It's very, very welcoming, friendly people, but an almost sort of feudal system in some ways.
Well, we remember horror stories of the royal family a few years ago and all that sort of stuff.
But yeah, I mean, but you know, it was an incredibly, unique environment where there's a place called Chimichanka, which this is a family audience, so I won't go into too much detail. But they've got some very unique artwork on the walls, let's say.
Worth going to. Would you go back to Bhutan?
I'd love to go back to Bhutan. Yeah.
And where else would you revisit along that trail? Because it's a hell of a walk that you did. You cover a lot of different civilizations, a lot of different tribal regions, a lot of different nations, a lot of different terrain. Do you have a natural affinity for more for mountains than rivers or valleys? I mean, you walk through Shangri-La, for heaven's sakes. It doesn't get better than that, surely.
No, I mean, that part of northern Pakistan was particularly special in terms of the natural, just the natural beauty. It was mind-blowing, it really was. And you know, that was a place that Wilfred Thesiger said was one of the most beautiful views he'd ever seen. And there is something just incredible about going to that region. But the whole route, you know, I've been to all of those places before, apart from Bhutan, and so it's difficult to pick a sort of a favourite place. All very, very different. You know, the remoteness and sheer wilderness of the Wakhan Corridor in Afghanistan just makes you feel like you are on the roof of the world, which is, you know, they call it Bami Dunyan, which is the roof of the world, and it's just so bleak and barren. It's worse than the Peak District. I mean, it's that bad, but it's so alluring as well. It's a very, very unique place. But then to go from that into the madness and the chaos of Plains India, you know, Haridwar, that was what appealed to me, was the diversity and the contrast between all those environments.
Of course, you're there, you've got the support of a television station behind you, you've got a film crew, you've got a producer helping you do your visas and people looking after your protection and security and safety and so on. But for those of us here who are of adventurous mind that think, actually, I've seen Leveson Wood walk the Himalayas, I want to do that. Mm-hmm. How possible is it for people like me, people like the audience here?
Well, I pretty much did it when I was 22, actually.
Right.
You know, I hitchhiked from London all the way down to southern India and followed much of the same route. So, you know, it is possible. It cost me £750. And that was including the £250 flight home. So it is doable. That was a slightly different
That was then.
Time. Afghanistan's not so safe now. But, you know, it's doable. You know, anyone can. You can go to the Wakhan Corridor, you can go to Pakistan, you can go to all the parts of India that I went to. Likewise, Nepal. Nepal's fine. You know, the earthquake is a long time ago now. The reconstruction has happened and ongoing. There's still parts that need help, but I think the best way that people can help is by visiting and putting some tourist dollars back into the economy. Likewise, Bhutan. So, you know, all of those places individually are visible. There's no reason you can't travel to all of them as I did.
I'm interested to see what you say that, you know, we can help by going to spending our tourist dollars, tourist pounds, especially in places like Nepal after the recent events of the terrible earthquake. What do you think of the morality of travelling like this these days, given that every time we jump on a flight, we're killing another little bit of the very planet that we're travelling to see? How does that balance work for you?
That's why I walk.
Yeah.
No, you're right. It's a difficult one to reconcile, isn't it? You know, the fact that, you know, on the one hand, you're looking at issues of climate change. On the other hand, you know, tourism is it's a sustainable industry, that one that works and has a very ground roots effect on, you know, to local people. Your money's going directly into communities and you can personally help people. So it's a difficult one, and I think it's for individuals to decide really how they want to sort of deal with that.
It's put to me very clearly by a man who recently died. You may have seen the guy flying the helicopter in Tanzania following elephant poachers, who's a pal of mine. And he said, Paul, the morality is actually really very clear. If you don't go to come to these countries, if you don't spend the money going into the wildlife parks and eating in the cafes and buying the souvenirs, they don't make the money that puts the bullets in the guns that keep the poachers out, or puts the petrol in the Land Rovers that allows them to protect the borders, that mean, or protect the, you know, the boundaries where these animals are protected, they will, these, the wardens and the game rangers will disappear. The animals will be killed, yep. and there'll be nothing to go and see. So it's a really important thing. Is we're going around, you know, some of the fantastic destination stands here, looking at where we're going, that actually there is a moral responsibility for where we spend our money, because it makes such a difference for the lives of the people that we connect with and that we contact with when we're in country, when we're in these places, mm. whether it's a boarding house, you know, or a tea shop somewhere, or a tea room in the, you know, up on the hippie trail up in the middle of Kashmir, or whether it's a game reserve in Tanzania. And I think, you know, it's something that we're increasingly aware of. That's, yeah. you know, I'm seeing a lot more here.
Anyway. And even in places like the Wakhan Corridor in Afghanistan, where, for instance, it's, you know, one of the last homes of the snow leopard.
Yes, of course.
You know, formerly, people, the locals would go out poaching or just hunting or simply protecting their livestock and killing these, you know, incredible animals. The fact that tourists, albeit very few, do go there means
to
that they
see
can
the snow leopard.
To see the snow leopard, yes, exactly. or at least be in that environment.
Right.
You know, people can see that very personal connection and say, you know what, actually, rather than choosing the snow leopard, I'm going to go and be a tourist guide. So you've now got former poachers turned into, you know, rangers and wardens, and that's happening across the world, especially in Africa. I think it's a good, it's a very positive thing, and that's only happening because, you know, people like us are going there and specifically wanting to see these places.
Poachers turn gamekeepers. Tell us how was this trip, the Himalayas trip, very different from the Nile trip? Was there a sort of difference in your own mindset? Apart from being shorter, of course.
Well, there were both places that I was personally interested in. I think that's, for me, that's what makes a journey. If it's a place that you're passionate about, it's a place that you're interested in, about the history, the you know, the culture, that's what makes a journey special. You know, yeah. I don't think I'd want to ever go down the route of just going to a place just to say that I've been there or just to make a TV program about it. I think it's important to have that personal connection. For me, the Himalayas, there was a very personal connection. You know, like I said, this is a place I travelled to when I was 19. I was there during a Maoist insurgency, which meant that I basically got looked after by a local guy called Binod. I'd managed to get my passport taken by a travel agent who disappeared along with the fighting kicked off.
Yeah.
I'd lost all my traveler's checks. I had no money, so I made a promise to my guide Binod and said, you know, one day, because I can't afford to pay you as a guide, one day I'll come back and get you involved in a big expedition. I don't think he was quite expecting me to come back 14 years later and make him walk the entire length of the Himalayas, but you know, it was that personal connection made this trip really special.
That's I love that underpinning of the journey. Is there any that you've got your heart set on going that you've not been to? I know that obviously you go to places that you've had a personal connection, but in order to go somewhere, you have to go somewhere to a first time. Is there a first time place you've got your... I'm not asking you to give away future TV documentaries or books, but...
There's lots of places. The world is a big place. And, you know, there's... I've actually not travelled very much in South America.
Right.
I'd like to go back there.
I'd quite like to see Levinson Wood walks the Andes.
Isn't Sue Perkins doing that?
There's a lot of it.
Yeah, there's a big one. I mean, look at that there. There's so many places that I'd like to go to.
Yeah.
I've never been to Canada. Papua New Guinea, I think that's got a bit of romance about it.
Great.
But yeah, I've got some more ideas for another TV series and book.
Good.
But I'm not going to tell you what they are.
Jolly good. Then I shan't ask. We'll have to wait. Tell us about how the writing works. Do you take notes? I mean, are you a walking writer that does day notes at the end of every day in a moleskin notebook when you're sitting having a cup of tea?
I do have a moleskin notebook. I kept a journal.
Right.
Although sometimes it's the last thing you want to do. After walking for 20 miles, you know, you're tired, it's wet, it's raining, you're getting your tent. All you want to do is zip yourself up and go to sleep. But you have to kind of have that discipline and treat it as a job, effectively, which is kind of what... It's a mindset you have to adopt, and I did. I kept a journal. Breaking my arm and having to have a sort of 4.5 week convalescence period was probably a blessing in disguise, and that meant I kept my publishers happy by writing the book on time, albeit one sort of button at a time.
Yeah.
But it did actually give me the opportunity to write 3/4 of the book up to the point, you know, where I was, you know, dangling off a cliff, literally. So that when I got back, having finished the journey, I only had the last couple of chapters to write. So,
great. But you wouldn't recommend breaking your arm as a
I'm not going to make a habit out of it.
Yeah, great. Actually, what, if there's one trick, one tip that you've learned from your travels, that whether it's about packing or avoiding getting blisters or stuff, can you pass on a bit of travel advice to all of us here who have watched you do these amazing trips? So do you have a simple trick, a simple tip?
I'll give you two.
Brilliant.
Two for the price of one. The first one being, I'm not a smoker, don't like it, but I always carry a packet of cigarettes because it turns out, certainly in the more remote and, say, risky areas, most gunmen do smoke, and it's always good to have something to break the ice with. So that's tip one. Tip two, I always have at least one clean linen shirt that I take with me. And that's because you just never know who you're going to bump into. For instance, the Dalai Lama. It might be a government official or a policeman, or you might get arrested. It's happened a few times. And you just need to, keep up appearances a bit and look a bit smart. And the number of times it happened, certainly in Africa, where, I remember crossing the border into Uganda, and I got a phone call on my little, Nokia local phone. And it turned out to be the Minister of Wildlife and Tourism. And I got no idea how he got my phone number, but he had. And he demanded that I pop into his office in Kampala when I reached there. So I thought, well, that's nice of him to invite me in for a cup of tea. I turned up and he sort of led me into this room, which was packed out, full of cameras. It was the entire national television, all the television crews. They were all there, rolling away. And he whispered in my ear, because he'd heard that I'd started my journey in Rwanda.
Yes.
As opposed to where most Ugandans, demand that the source of the Nile is in Lake Victoria. Correct. In Uganda. And as we were going onto the stage to have a press conference, he whispered into my ear, if you don't tell everybody that the source of the Nile is in Uganda, I'm not going to give you permission to carry on your walk. So I had to be quite diplomatic there. And it's the linen shirt definitely came in handy.
It's much better advice than my grandfather taught me when I was a teenager and started, where he said, always take a dinner jacket in case you're invited to the embassy. I've never done it, always T-shirts, but twice I've been invited to the embassy and wish I'd taken a bloody
dinner. There you go.
Listen, we have a massive audience here. In fact, I think you are officially the biggest audience for one of the Stanford's Travel Writing Festival events that we've held here at this festival. So well done you. We traditionally open up to you so you get to ask questions of our guest. As there are so many, we're going to start a little early. Fantastic, you heard me. It's not often you get to have FaceTime with Leveson. Here's your chance. Who would like to ask him a question? Don't all put your hands up at once. Now, I don't know how the hell you're going to get there, but there's a lady with a green shirt there. So we'll start with her, and then we'll go to the lady with a striped shirt standing at the back, if we may. But lady with green shirt first. Thank you very much for... we'll start with you. Okay, fine.
It's really simple question. I was wondering how it was having your brother arrive when you've been out in the wilderness with Vinod and sort of a completely different space to have someone from home suddenly turning up.
In terms of what, the film crew or...?
No, your brother turned up.
Oh, my brother, sorry, yeah. Yes. Yeah, yeah. So my brother, he'd always wanted to come with me on on one of my journeys, and... he decided to come out to Nepal. I think he kind of regretted that decision after about a day and found himself at the bottom of this cliff. But, it is always nice to have, friends come out, even if it's just for a few days or a week. And, I was lucky. I was travelling in areas where it is quite accessible and it is easy for people to fly in. So why not? I don't consider myself, one of these sort of endurance athletes that, I'm carrying all my gear and all that. It's great that people do that, but... for me, it's about the journey, it's about the people you meet, and it's about sharing those experiences. So, I was very glad to have him there, because actually, when I did have the accident, luckily he was sort of the best out of everyone that was in the car and pretty much saved the day. And he hadn't done a great deal of travelling before himself, and, he was the one pulling me out of the wreckage, so I'm glad he was there.
Good for him. Lady here in green. Lady here in green.
Yeah, Mr. Wood.
Hello.
Hello. Leveson. Lev. Just want to let you know about my grandchildren, who are three under 10.
Three and 10.
Three under 10.
Could you hold the microphone in front of your mouth?
Is that okay?
That's
better.
Thank
you very much.
Thank you. I just want you to be aware of the impact you have on children.
Okay.
Because I have three grandchildren, 10.
Pray God, let it be good.
Yeah, I'm fingers crossed here.
They've watched The Village in Bhutan, okay. By the way. They've seen that.
Oh, right.
But it's the impact that you have because they followed you down the Nile. They watched each episode twice.
That was supposed to be post-Watershed, by the way. But
yes, yes. We do it in bed together. And the journey that you did through the Himalayas. But one thing that came across was when you had your shoulder injury, you needed to get the air to it. And how many times have you tried to tell a child that they don't use a Band-Aid? So thank you for that.
Oh, no, my pleasure. It was disgusting.
But I don't have any questions.
That's very lovely, Anadu. Thank you.
But the Nullarbor plane is waiting for you.
Thank you very much. I look forward to seeing it.
Superb. And lady with the striped shirt.
Hello.
Hello.
Just wanted to ask, what did it mean to you to be able to do so much of the trip with Binod?
I mean, ultimately, that was why I went back. You know, Binod was the reason that I sort of returned to the Himalayas and... like I said, to have that personal connection just made the trip all the more special, and to be able to pay that back to a guy that I've known for so long, and it was just really nice, you know, and to see his family again. And when I visited him when I was 19, you know, he had a little baby. Now he's got three lovely kids, and you know, to go back and see them was just a really amazing privilege. So yeah, it was good.
Can I flip that on its head? Do you have any insights into what it meant to Binod to do the trip with you?
I think for him, you know, I like to keep a promise, and I said I'd like to come back and do whatever I could in a small way to help him personally, and I think it, you know, it meant a lot to him, both from a, you know, a personal point of view, but also I guess from a business point of view. You know, he hopefully off the back of this, he will continue his life as a guide, and yeah, anyone that wants to go to Nepal, I'll happily give you his email and take him as a guide. He's a great guy.
There you go. You could retrace Leveson's steps with his guide.
How's his foot?
Where are we looking?
Over here.
Thank you very much.
How has Binod's foot? He was at the end of the film. He was hobbling around.
He was.
We were very worried about him.
Yeah, so was I. He was okay. His feet's okay now. He just struggled a bit. He went, sort of his ankle had swollen up a bit, and I think there was more to it than that. I think he's quite superstitious, and I think for those that might have seen the show or indeed read the book, about a week before we'd met a Buddhist monk in one of the temples, one of the monasteries in Bhutan, who'd predicted that out of the team, somebody was going to come off worse for wear. And I think, you know, I wasn't really into the superstition, but my local guide Jamyang certainly was, although he didn't tell me at the time what the exact translation, so he kept that one to himself. But I think there was a kind of sense of foreboding where we didn't know how it was going to end up, and there was this very, very remote valley and all of these unclimbed peaks. There's something quite menacing about that, knowing that all of these mountains nobody's ever been to the top of. And so it was a little bit terrifying to be in this environment. And I think there was a part of that had been playing on Binod's mind, and, you know, he just didn't want to take any chances, and fair play, you know, he's a family man, he's got three kids, and I certainly wasn't going to push him to do something that he wasn't comfortable with, so...
We have a question here at the front, but it's going to be easier. Oh, hold on.
You're stuck.
We have a question here at the front, but it's going to be easier if I do this. So hold on one second. There
you go. Hi.
Hi.
First of all, thank you so much for inspiring my friend to walk the Camino Trail in Spain, and for inspiring so many other people. And I just wanted to know, out of all of the countries you've visited, is there one that you would kind of live in for the rest of your life? Which one would it be and why?
One that I would live in. So the question was, out of all the countries I've been to, where would I live? Well, I always love coming back to the UK, actually, and by the end of a 6-month or a 9-month trip, I'm pretty much ready for home, usually. So I kind of appreciate that. It certainly makes you more grateful for what you've got when you do come back. If I was told you've got to leave tomorrow, if I get deported or I have to do a runner, then I'd probably go to South Africa. There's something really special about Cape Town in particular I love. That's probably the city that I would go to. Yeah.
You said you don't believe in superstition, the answer to the previous question. Mm. and I don't know you well enough to ask this very personal question, so forgive me if he suddenly punches me in the face, but do you have a spiritual side? Is there, do you find there's something sort of inwardly uplifting when you're walking through? Often with long walks, there is something very reflective and almost transcendental about them. Do you find this? Is there an aspect of that to you?
I think one of the things that I learned from both walking a plumbing long way across Africa and likewise along the in the Himalayas was it has that way of reaffirming your faith in humanity, because wherever you go, people generally are pretty good and they'll look after you, and you kind of, all the stuff you see in the media, and it's a cliche, but you do have to take it with a pinch of salt, and it tends to be that the worse reputation a country has, that the friendlier the people actually are. And
right.
You go to Afghanistan, you go to Pakistan, Sudan, Iraq, the people are great. The people have always looked after me, you know, probably more than in other places. So there is something about that kind of gives you that warm, fuzzy feeling. Likewise, if you've been involved in anything tragic or an accident, you know, I on both journeys I've had, you know, the sort of worst possible scenarios happen. And it's the local people that you rely on. And I think when you have that and you're looked after very well, that you do come away, I don't know whether it's spiritual or whether it's just, you know, happy with your lot.
Yeah. I like the way you put it. It reaffirms your faith in humanity. Simon Reeve and I were talking about earlier about some of the hideous places we've been to in terms of incredible political duress, and found so much human warmth that actually they become much more sort of fulfilling than an average holiday. More questions for Leveson. Is anybody over here? We have a gentleman here, second row from the front. Well done, Roddy, on being so slim, large.
Thanks. Firstly, congratulations on a great second series. My question was, after the crash, was there any point at which you thought it wasn't worth continuing or going on?
It's a very good question. Immediately after the crash, I was so high on morphine that I thought I was just going to, it would take 2 days and I'd be back on the road. It wasn't quite that simple. I didn't realise, because obviously I needed to get an x-ray. I thought my arm was a little bit wonky, but I didn't realise the extent of the damage. But no, I don't think I ever really thought about giving up. Got bills to pay. You
of
know?
Course you did. You were in the parachute regiment, for heaven's sakes.
No, not really. I had to finish it. I'd set off on this journey, and I wasn't going to let the small matter of a broken arm stop it.
Push on, keep smiling. Question for the lady here, please.
I'm just wondering what you miss most when you go away, and what would you have with you if you could take it?
It's like Desert Island Discs.
It is, isn't it? And what's the one thing?
What would your luxury be?
Well, I think because you kind of put your life in a box, everything goes on hold, you don't expect luxuries, and so you don't miss them. It's the simple things, you know, it's having a good cup of tea and a slice of toast, really. That's the things you kind of crave. And ultimately, it's the simple things. You know, I don't mind not sleeping in a nice bed for a few weeks or a few months at a time. It's just the old home comfort occasionally. Food generally, actually, yeah.
Do you take a little luxury with you? I often take a little travelling pot of Marmite with me when I go. Yeah.
I sometimes take one of those little Tabasco things, but they run out pretty quickly. So yeah.
You smear the Marmite on, by the way. It keeps mosquitoes away.
Hi, Leveson.
Hi.
I watched both your series, The Nile and Himalayas. Thought they were absolutely fantastic, so well done on that. And I just wanted to ask you, when you had these ideas of doing The Nile and the Himalayas, did you approach Channel 4 and say, I've got this fantastic project, do you want to be a part of this and film? Or did they approach you? How did that kind of come about with Channel 4?
Very long story short, I left the regular army about 6 years ago, without any clue what on earth I was going to do whatsoever, apart from the fact that I really liked travelling and didn't want to get a proper job. So on that basis, I set up a company that specialised really in taking media types, film crews, journalists to risky places. So I took, National Geographic, Discovery Channel, Channel 4, to places like Afghanistan, Iraq, Sudan. And you know, looked after them, did the logistics, the security, and it was actually on one of those trips. I was working with Channel 4 on a project, and I happened to be in South Sudan, standing on the banks of the Nile, and the director said to me, look, you're doing some interesting things. How, you know, do you fancy pitching an idea to Channel 4, and we'll make a film about it? And, you know, you can't really turn something like that down. I'd always dreamt of writing a travel and an adventure book, and I thought it would be a great platform to do so. And he said, have you got any ideas? And I sort of looked around, saw this whopping great big river, and said, I'll go and walk that.
How many of us, given that opportunity, would have been going, yes! we've got time. No, I have to wrap up. I have to wrap up because we have to make two announcements. Firstly, thank you to you for being a bloody wonderful audience. Forgive my language. Secondly, you will notice a lot of people have not been sitting on seats, but have been sitting on the floor. Thank you to you, and thank you to your wonderful bottoms for putting up with it. If you are sitting on a seat, would you let the people sitting on the floor exit first so they can get out? Leveson, as you will guess, has a superb book, which is on sale over there. It is brilliantly written, and there are not many people who are really good at presenting a TV show on travel, but equally then writing about it lucidly and from the heart, and I highly commend this to you. It's on sale there. He'll be signing it over there. I would also announce he's not going to have time to do dedications, so he will just sign it for you, if that's all right. But thank you to you for being a wonderful audience. Thank you to Stanford's for letting this happen, but mostly, thank you to this man, Leveson Wood.
Thank you very much.
Bless you, love.
Thanks, Paul.